This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Pens and paper are dead, and screens have taken over our lives. That's the message we're hearing from all sides these days, and it's prompted lots of research about changes in our brains and how we communicate. But there is one corner of our culture where pens, paper, and even scissors and glue are alive and well, and that is the world of zines. For the unfamiliar, zines are handmade self-publications. It can be about almost anything from politics to music to the arts and raw personal experience. Zines actually date back to the 1930s and grew out of science fiction fan culture. They evolved through the 80s and 90s alongside changes in photocopy technology and really burst to a broader public consciousness in the 1990s with the Riot Girl punk rock movement. Although zine making died down a bit with the expansion of the internet, zines are now having something of a resurgence. So today we'll talk about the zine phenomenon. Joining us first is Cindy Crabb. She's creator of Doris, an autobiographical zine that's been around since the early 1990s. Doris has been included in a number of zine anthologies and is archived at the zine collection at Duke University. Cindy used to live in Asheville for 12 years and is now in Ohio, where she joins us. Hello, Cindy Crabb.
Hi.
Before you started writing Doris, you had been working on both a political magazine and writing fiction. Tell us why you decided to make a zine.
I was really interested in sort of what voices were getting heard, both politically and in literature, and the tones and subjects that were allowed in those spaces. So when I first saw zines, I was just so inspired by what freedom was there, how flexible the mode was. There was just such a wide variety of things you could write about, ways you could express yourself. I was also really interested in how alienated we all were in society, and I loved temporary art and being able to make these little precious things full of secrets that I could give to people and break some of that alienation.
What is it about that form that makes the difference for you?
For me, I liked the tactile aspect of it, and I liked that you could just give it to someone in person, very face-to-face experience, and also that it was something that anybody could do. And I think this is kind of the key thing for me, was that I thought I wanted as many people as possible to be putting their voices out there and feeling like they could contribute to culture and the creation of community and breaking the sort of alienated, singular voices that we had.
It's interesting. There's a kind of paradox in there, in the sense that if you want as many voices as possible, you would think, well, let's use the big wide internet and reach 1 billion people. But it's precisely what I'm hearing you saying is precisely the intimacy and the message that anybody can do it. So the recipient is receiving not only the content of your zine, but also a message that I can do this too.
Exactly. And I think the difference between like the internet and this is that what I really wanted was for our own communities that we were living in to widen what we talked about together. So as opposed to the internet, where it just goes out there and anybody can read it in any you know, time and place, like this was a very time and place specific thing. And if we were all like passing around these zines and in a singular community, it really broadened what we talked about.
You wrote a piece for a collection of Doris zines called I Believe that talks about your mission for Doris. I wonder if you would read a bit of that for us now.
Sure. I Believe. I started writing a zine because I believed in the power of telling secrets. I believed that so much of our lives were closed up and hidden. The sweet things and the scary things and the small beautiful things and the way we learned to survive. I believed in fundamental social change. I wanted to live in a world without rape, and to create that world, we had to change everything, the whole basis of our society. I wanted to live in a world where we were humans and not just consumers, where our voices mattered, where we learned together instead of just arguing. I wrote a zine because I felt like the public face of feminism had been watered down, and I wanted to change that. I believed in the quote, "What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The whole world would explode." I wanted the world to explode. I wanted our truths to be told.
That's Cindy Crabb, the creator and author of the zine Doris, reading the piece called I Believe. Later in the piece, you talk about the idea of this being, you know, the part of the idea of your feeling alone. And I wonder if things actually did change for you, if your feeling changed as you wrote this zine and distributed it.
Yeah, it did. There were a lot of things that I felt were very secret, and it was hard to talk about with people, particularly around abuse stuff, but also around the beautifulness of the world. So it was both sides of the spectrum. And by writing the zine, you know, I had a P.O. box, and so people would write me back. And having that connection with other people through the mail was really, really helpful in making me feel less alone, but also giving it to my community and to my friends and people that I interacted with helped broaden what we talked about, which also helped me make feel alone. So it helped normalize some of these conversations about sexual abuse and also about survival, and that helped me.
Joining us now is Kelly Wooten. She's the Research Services Collection Development Research Services and Collection Development Librarian at Duke Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture. The center is home to more than 6,000 zines, including Doris. And Kelly joins me in the studio now. Kelly Wooten, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
Tell us, we talked about the zine resurgence. Can you tell us more about that and what we're seeing these days?
Well, I think that people are starting to feel a little bit of burnout from all that screen culture. So being tired of the internet culture of commenting and negativity and wanting to return to more handmade things. You see like the Etsy marketplace selling handmade items and objects for the home, but you also see people wanting to write and produce artwork that's more handmade and less computer-based, and also continue to have these conversations that aren't necessarily being covered in the mainstream media on TV or in the news or also online. And when you do have those conversations online about abuse, about people's real experiences of sexual harassment on the street or in their communities, you have all this room for other voices to jump in and disagree or discount their experiences. So when you create a zine, you're having that handmade, intimate experience of producing something that you can hold and still continue to, like Cindy was talking about, hand it from person to person.
We're talking about the resurgence of zines today on The State of Things. Kelly Wooten is with me from the Duke Library. Cindy Crabb writes Doris, an autobiographical zine. And Cindy, you talk about that distribution. You were handing it out on buses, right?
Yeah. When I first wrote it, it was very full of secrets. And so I wouldn't give it to people I knew. I would just give it to strangers on the bus. And it was a way of trying to break our secrets and break our silences. And
did it generate conversations right there on the bus, or did you have to wait and get something in your post box?
Definitely not right on the bus.
Just wondering, you hand somebody something like this and it is provocative. It's like, well, what do I do with this? What reactions
for sure
did you get?
Well, I would actually usually give it to people like as I was leaving the bus.
Okay.
So it was like a little present, you know.
Kelly, tell us how zines got started. Those of us who have any consciousness at all of zines will remember their making the scene back in the 90s, but they've been around for a long time, right?
Yes. Like you mentioned in the introduction, the science fiction fanzines were the first emergence of this kind of publication. This publication called The Comet, which came out in 1930, is usually noted as the first zine. It was created more like a newsletter for fans who were critiquing and discussing science fiction, culture, writing their own stories, kind of very similar to modern blogs and forum where people really love something and they're passionate about it and they want to talk about it with others. And these newsletters were a way to find other people in the 1930s when you didn't have these options available to you.
Were they mostly text or were there graphics also?
There are some drawings and mostly text, typewritten text, and then they were produced on a mimeograph or other early duplicating technology.
This is a way to sort of keep especially in sci-fi, you kind of make these worlds real and then share your critiques with friends. So the resurgence in the 90s, what was happening there and how is that different?
Well, by the 1990s, you had really widely available photocopiers in copy shops on every corner, or people, you know, teenagers and young people in low-wage jobs had access to copiers at work and other places. So you had a lot more available technology. And then you also had alternative music scene, which is really the main core of where zine culture was coming out of. So this subculture community that really coalesced around alternative music was also creating their own art and writing and creating their own culture and using zines as a format to share that.
Well, you got the combination of accelerated technology with the DIY culture that's you know, and they come together in the 90s. And kind of interesting, and there's kind of a Kinko's subculture as well, where people hung out and could work deals with their pals at Kinko's.
Yes, there's zines also shared information about how to scam copies and how to basically get away with stealing or getting copies for free or cheap.
All part of the culture. Then things went underground a bit and are back today. We'll talk more about that with Kelly Wooten, Research Services and Collection Development Librarian at Duke Sally Bingham Center. Cindy Crabb is the author and creator of Doris, an autobiographical zine that's been around since the early 90s. Both of them will be with us as we continue our conversation about zines on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about zines, handmade, independently produced publications about anything from pop culture to politics. Still with us is Cindy Crabb, who's been writing and publishing the zine Doris since the early 90s. Kelly Wooten is a Duke librarian who works with their collection of more than 6,000 zines. And joining us now is Janice Radway. She's a professor at Northwestern University, currently a fellow at the National Humanities Center in Durham. She's working on a book about girl zines, and she will talk about her research at the National Humanities Center tomorrow night at 6, but first joins us in our studio. Janice, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
We talked about punk culture being part of the resurgence of zines in the 90s, and particularly the Riot Girl scene takes a turn maybe in zine culture. Tell us about that and the intersection of those two worlds.
Well, there were many zines in the punk world, even in the late 70s and 80s. Riot Girl is a fascinating loose social movement that developed out of and in response to the activities of an extraordinary group of young women who were college students for the most part on the West Coast in Olympia, Washington, and in Seattle. And they were responding both to the alternative music scene and to the larger culture of the late 80s and early 90s, which was characterized by a kind of backlash against feminism. And these young women were angry about that backlash. They were also angry about a lot of things, including the kind of misogyny and violence that you would see in what was considered a male-dominated scene, although it wasn't totally male-dominated because women have been very active in punk from the beginning. So the women associated with some of the early Riot Girl bands were Kathleen Hanna, Toby Vail, Kathy Wilcox with Billy Karen, and they were in a band called Bikini Kill. There was also Bratmobile, Heavens to Betsy, and a number of others. What's really interesting about Riot Girl is they had very complicated and very rich politics. Their early zines make it clear that although they were very focused on feminism, they also were very interested in anti-capitalist, non-commercial politics. They were interested in environmentalism. They were interested in anarchism. But as they became popular, there was a great deal of opposition to them within the punk scene, and the mainstream media picked up on the Riot Girls. And so mainstream media, because they were interested in the state of feminism, because of this debate, they then found the Riot Girls controversial, extraordinary, and worth talking about. And so then there was a great deal of media attention directed at Riot Girls.
How closely were they related? I mean, you talk about the Riot Girls scene, and we think about it in terms of music. Was it an offshoot, or was it there from the start? Was it, you know, sort of part and parcel of this movement and this, you know, this particular form of speech?
Do you mean the punk part or the musical part of the
zines?
No,
I mean the zine part. So zines as a publication, as an offshoot. I mean, if music is kind of the centerpiece of Riot Girl or what we think of you know, where did the publications come
Well,
in?
Actually, many of these young women associated with the bands had already created zines before. So it's very important to understand, although people write about zines, and especially girl zines, as if they originated in Riot Girl. In fact, women's zining and girl zining existed prior to the sort of explosion of Riot Girl. So all of these people, including Toby Vail and Kathleen Hanna, had done zines before that. Toby Vail did a zine called Jigsaw. Kathleen Hanna did one that has a title like The Only Good Girl is a Dead Girl or something like that. So zining was part of the alternative music scene. And these were also young women who were very involved in the arts at college, at Evergreen State College. And so they were very interested in the production and the handmade nature of this. So it was a kind of extension of an entire world. And I think it's really important to understand that zines come out of this kind of subculture that's very rich and that's very bringing together both aesthetics and politics.
And it's interesting that they were not seduced by capitalist replication of that culture, right? I mean, the whole idea that you said when mainstream media caught on, this might be our big moment, that they're finally paying attention. And in fact, the Riot Girl movement turns its back on all of that.
Yes, they were very disturbed by the way they were being written about, simplified, and the way they were being caricatured in the mainstream press. And so they also, it was, as you say, contrary to their politics, which were, you know, I think, coming out of a kind of anarchism, and they decided that they simply wouldn't speak to the press any longer. It was also a moment at which some of the bands coming out of the Northwest, like Nirvana, were beginning to go mainstream, and there was a great deal of angry conversation within the alternative music scene about whether that was selling out, whether that was destroying the community. So I think that was also part of the Riot Girl's response to mainstream media.
It is fascinating, because the simplest way to neutralize dissent has been, in this particular system, to co-opt it and commodify it. And once you put a dollar sign on it, suddenly the dissent and the critique is pretty much neutralized.
Well, what's really interesting about zines is that even though the mainstream media did commodify, you could say commodified Riot Girl and commodified zines, those mainstream media reports actually produced more interest in zining among young girls. So there's a very important book written by Sarah Marcus called Girls to the Front, and it begins with her discovering the idea of zines and Riot Girl through a report in Newsweek. So what's fascinating about zines is they are this amazing coming together of deeply idiosyncratic and quirky observations with reflection on cultural categories and cultural behavior, aesthetics and politics. And there's something about that uniqueness in a zine that captivates just about every reader who picks them up. And as a consequence, people are spurred to do them on their own.
Well, Cindy, how about you? Did you consider yourself part of the Riot Girl movement?
I didn't consider myself part of it at the time, but in looking back at it, I feel like I definitely was part of the wider circle of what was Riot Girl. It's interesting because I found out about Riot Girl through that same Newsweek article. But the thing was, there was a whole sort of confrontational feminist stuff happening in the anarchist scene at the time. I was more involved in the anarchist and anti-racist scene, and the anti-racist action had like a girl gang. There were girl gangs in the political side. So I think that those two things sort of connected, the girl gangs that were happening in the political, anti-racist, anarchist scene, and then also this more cultural production coming out of the music scene. And what I really loved about Riot Girl was that their zines had everything combined, mixed up in it. So like when you wrote about politics, you had to have your argument had to be articulated and solid, and you had to be able to argue any kind of dissent that might come out of it, right? But Riot Girl combined like their political argument with like how crazy they felt and their personal experiences in this like cut and paste, scrappy way that was like, we are way more complex than one single argument. And that was what really spoke to me.
And overall, we talk about these large issues that you've been talking about, and then these very personal feelings and emotions. And your zine became known for handling a kind of raw, and talking about raw, vulnerable experiences, experiences of trauma and sexual assault. Tell us more about that.
I wanted to write about those issues not in like a purging sort of diary way, although I think that's an important format too, but I wanted to be able to write about trauma in a way that was that showed people paths towards complex healing. And also, what one of the things I really was felt was important about my zine was that I tried to evoke all emotions in a single zine. So I would have something about trauma, you know, but I would also have some just short story of a beautiful interaction I had, you know, or something really pretty I'd seen on the street, and then sort of a funny story. So within the zine itself, all emotions would be evoked, and that was part of a path towards healing, too, and towards a deeper political analysis of why traumatic things happened and what we needed to do, not just to heal ourselves, but to change a world that silenced those things and to change a world to keep them from happening.
When you were telling the personal stories, did you feel the need to remain anonymous? Did you not want to be well known?
I didn't want, you know, my family to read them, for instance. So I did, you know, have a different name that I used. I tried not to write about the things that would totally destroy me if someone read them. You know, I tried to sort of write around the trauma until I got strong enough to write about the bigger stuff.
Well, let me ask the question, the broader question to Kelly Wooten, who's been archiving these. What does your archive show about these, the places that they provided for these kinds of conversations and the role of anonymity, Kelly?
Well, I think there is, being anonymous in the zine world is pretty complex. It's something we think about as zine librarians. There's a large community of zine librarians across the country that think about this in terms of cataloging them and how to approach that. You know, like Cindy said, she wrote under a pseudonym earlier, and then later her zine became associated with her name, which happens in a lot of zines. They start out anonymously. For example, Bust Magazine, which is a glossy magazine now, started out as a zine, and the editors all had pseudonyms in those first issues. So I think people kind of decide what level of anonymity they want. They might, some publish their first and last names, their home addresses, some use a false name and a P.O. box, or don't even put any kind of contact information on their zine. So I think zines are a really great way to talk about really sensitive topics and still choose your level of privacy.
Mm-hmm. Janice, what about we talked about the role that feminism played, certainly in the debate over how this should be perceived and distributed. What role do you think zines have played in the evolution of feminism?
Oh, I think they've had an enormous impact, and they're continuing to have an enormous impact, in part because this extraordinary group of young women who were associated with Riot Girl or like Cindy Crabb, connected to it in really interesting ways. Those young women have been and developed since then, many of them, into cultural activists of one sort or another, into artists, into people who have some kind of public voice now. So many former zinesters are well-known writers. They are filmmakers, television producers. They are librarians and archivists. They are public speakers. They are people who are involved in producing a show like Portlandia. Carrie Brownstein was associated with Riot Girl. So this group of young women now have a public presence, and as a consequence, their desire to write these zines and also to produce extraordinary music that brings together, in the way Cindy suggested, deeply personal secrets with the public conditions that produced those kinds of traumas, that ability to bring those things together, I think, is having an enormous impact on feminism now. And so you will see there are many feminist blogs, for instance, that have roots in and connections, ties to Riot Girl and girl zines. They're not the same thing. I think they're changed by the format. But I do feel that this is having an impact on feminism.
What about the impact on expanding the scope or definition of feminism? It had been under debate for a couple of decades since the 70s, how much to include. You mentioned kind of anti-neoliberalism and anti-capitalist and ecological components to feminism that had always been in contention. What was the role of zines, if any, in sort of forging that as, or allowing that to be part of this broader definition?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'm extremely interested in that because I'm very interested in the way how we categorize these things matters. And so I'm very interested in historicizing, that is, creating a history of how the category of girl zines got produced and how the category of girl zine archives got produced. They are both political achievements, but it's also, I think, very important to say that in producing those kinds of categories, what happens is that we tend to leave out certain sorts of complexities that one sees in individual zines, zine collections, and in the movement. One of the first things I noticed when I went to see the zine collection at Smith was I was looking at this amazing collection of material with the idea that these were girl zines, and I thought, wait a minute, there are all kinds of zines by young men here. There are zines that are connected to feminism, but they're really more interested in veganism, or they're very more interested in anarchism. So then I began to think about, well, what's going on here? What is the relationship between these feminist zines and all of these other political things? And so what I want to try and draw attention to is the way in which these kind of feminist performances, feminist activism, was also part and parcel of the work of a particular cohort of young people in the 80s and 90s who had grown up at a particular moment. And I think we're actually very creatively trying to reimagine what it would mean to be a political actor, how we would think about different politics, how we would associate with each other in different kinds of communities. That's why I think somebody like Cindy's work is really important, because of the way she thinks about community, anarchism, and its relationship to individualism.
We are talking about the resurgence of zines today on The State of Things. Cindy Crabb, the relative cheapness of zines also kind of played an important part in the conversation when you're talking about the intersection of class and politics. You have a piece from your zine called Robin, I think, that speaks to some of these class dynamics. Would you read some of it for us?
Sure. Sometimes I think me and Robin speak two different languages. She says, "Do you think people will ever voluntarily change and start living sustainably?" In her voice is accusation. Her voice says I'm an idiot if I answer anything other than no. But I think yes. I'm thinking about my neighbors in Laurel, one of the most economically depressed rural areas in America, and how one of the daughters left and came back with a grant to try to help turn things around. She was hosting a series of workshops in the community center. The one I went to was on raising oyster mushrooms. "Where's the market for that?" one of the farmers asked. She said if enough farmers would commit, they could start a community processing center and sell soup mix to the hikers on the Appalachian Trail. Most of the farmers' faces were a mix of sadness and disgust and anger and skepticism. Where's the honest work in that? Is that the best we can hope for in our lives? Is this the best dream and the best solution we can come up with? There was anger and resignation and desire for something different, an answer to an unarticulated question. And despite the big screen televisions and the all-terrain vehicles, I think most people want something else. Like the guy sitting next to me on the plane, he said, "I went to a few anti-war protests, but I never could figure out what to do from there." Like when the snow falls 3 feet overnight in Minneapolis and everything's shut down except people's faces, which are bright and happy, looking each other in the eyes, shoveling each other out. Meaningful work. I think people are dying for meaningful work. I think people are desperate for meaning. And the lengths the ruling class has to go to in order to keep us pacified is a testament to our continuing desire for true freedom. Yes, I tell Robin, yes, I think people will voluntarily change. Robin says, "I don't think you should fly out here. Do you know what a big carbon imprint planes make?" And I say, "How about if I off a businessman first? They fly every week." And when I get to her after car, plane, bus, ferry, bus, I climb into her truck and match my hand to hers. Lips on ear, lips on throat. I'm glad you're here, she says. This language we share. Robin says this is not political as she touches my ribs and I grab her in handfuls. And we call together into nest, warmth, heat, feeling. Political, yes, political, I say. Because this is what it feels like to be alive, full in the body, heartbeat to heartbeat alive, beyond hope. I want everyone to feel this much, this sweet. Hope, she says. Hope is nothing but denial. But I think hope is like a crush. Not the resigned hope, like I hope things get better, but the hope that feels like suspended disbelief, where spaces open up and everything is possible again, and you're pushed to adventure, pushed out of your regular boxes, pushed to show off, to be the person you want to be the most, working hard to show your best sides, your secret scars, your hidden dreams. Hope is like a crush, making things as beautiful as possible, even knowing you'll get hurt. It won't sustain you, not like the hard work of love will, but it pushes you beyond what you thought you were capable of. I am not optimistic, but hope, yes, hope.
That is Cindy Crabb, the creator and author of the zine Doris, reading from a piece called Robin. Thank you so much, Cindy, for reading that, and thank you for being with us on The State of Things today.
Thank you.
We're going to continue our conversation on The State of Things about zines, the resurgence of zines on The State of Things. You can find out more about Cindy and see some excerpts from her zine, Doris, at our website, stateofthings.org. We have more guests coming up. We'll talk about the resurgence of zines and where they go from here when our program continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about zines, self-published handmade magazines, about a wide range of topics. They've been around really since the 1930s. They've had a resurgence today, despite our turn toward technology. We've been talking with Kelly Wooten, a Duke librarian who works with their collection of more than 6,000 zines. Janice Radway is currently a fellow at the National Humanities Center in Durham. She's working on a book about girl zines. We're joined now by Nikki Gomez. She's the founder of Brown Recluse Zine Distro. It's a zine distributor geared toward zines written by and for people of color, and she joins us from Seattle. Nikki, welcome to The State of Things.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
We're very pleased to have you on the program. You came to the zine culture a bit later than some of the movements that we've been talking about. It was around 2004, am I right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as a teenager, I came to it in the late 90s, but I started producing and making content in about 2004.
Tell us about your first exposure and what attracted you to it. What did you like about it?
My first exposure to zines, I have to say, would be when I was a teenager to Maximum Rock and Roll, which is a punk zine that's still running. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about it was being able to connect with people or read about different people's experiences in punk that weren't close to mine, especially in Arizona, where I didn't really feel like I had anybody or any friends that were into the same things that I was into as a teenager. And then later on, about 2000, I was just looking for resources around trauma and sexual assault and survival and stumbled upon all of those zines through friends being like, here's this, you know. And then later on from there, in 2004, I was living in Portland, Oregon, and was working down the street from a cafe that sold zines. And then from there, I just kind of fell in love and then started writing my own zine.
Well, tell us about that. Yeah, your decision to write your own zine.
I just felt like I had a lot to say and a lot that I wanted to share and connect on. And then I wasn't really finding that on a construction site in Portland, Oregon. So that's where that started. And it was really embarrassing, my first zine.
Tell us about that. What you were writing? What was your first zine?
I was actually writing a lot about sexuality within like anarchist communities and talking about, you know, my relationship to what I was experiencing, which was a lot like a resurgence of like second wave feminism and not feeling very comfortable within that movement of that. So that was what my zine talked about a lot. And I had actually got an interview with Carol Queen in that zine. And that was really exciting for me at the time.
Did you feel the need to remain anonymous when you were first writing zines?
No, yeah. I've never been anonymous in writing zines.
And I'm curious about the distribution too, because this to me is one of the more curious elements. This is a very important message, anyone you talk to who produces zines, who studies zines, or who distributes them talks about the importance of feeling this connection. And so, you know, one would imagine in this world of mass communications, you want to get the message out to as many people as possible so you can touch as many lives. And yet this is a real intimate hand-to-hand kind of proposition. Talk to me about the paradox of wanting to reach people, of the feeling you had, of feeling a connection, but not using a system that's going to mass produce the object.
Well, at the time when I first started writing zines, the internet didn't feel like a very big thing. So, I mean, finding connection through mail was still like super important. And even now today, like, it doesn't feel as real when someone likes your Facebook post or comments, you know, and feels weird, really real when someone sends you a package full of zines or a postcard or puts something in the mail and puts effort into it, you know.
Tell us why you decided then to found Brown Recluse.
I decided to found Brown Recluse Zine Distro because I have felt like throughout all of zine history, like just studying zine history and being around zinesters and stuff, that the voices of people of color have always been severely marginalized in the zine community. Just even in the conversation, just listening now, like that was, race wasn't brought up, you know. It's like not something that's thought about or talked about, even though that was like developing in the zine community during Riot Girl and even before like the science fiction zines and stuff like that. Like there were zines written by folks who were by African Americans in this country as early as 1912.
Right. Well, Janice,
so yeah, it's just a forgotten history, I felt like. So that was kind of like why I started Brown Recluse, was like, okay, I really want to open this dialogue up wider and make voices more available.
Janice Radway, you have studied the history of this movement. What is the role of race and people of color in producing zines?
It's incredibly important, it has, I think, begun to change how people narrate the history, in particular, of girl zines, but in general. Various people have been involved in something called the People of Color Zine Tour. But various zinesters, various punks of color have been involved for a long time, publishing pieces in Maximum Rock and Roll and Punk Planet, in a number of other places, critiquing the argument that punk was only white and suggesting that, in fact, while there was a kind of dominance of what Mimi Nguyen has called white straight boy mentality, there were actually people, punks of color, from the very beginning, and they were participating in punk really all over the world. I mentioned Mimi Nguyen because her work has been incredibly influential and very important. She really first began writing about these issues in her own zines, Slant, Slander, a number of others, and then also in Punk Planet and in Maximum Rock and Roll. And those kinds of critiques developed into a much more sustained discussion of the way the history of even Riot Girl has been conducted and the way the history of girl zines have been conducted. And she has developed, along with the various people she's associated with, a sustained argument that suggests that, in fact, that narrative excludes work that was going on at the same time, that was sparked by different kinds of political concerns. And so she wants to see and argue that we need to take account of that. And I think that critique is incredibly important. And I think it speaks to something that both Cindy and Nikki were getting at, which is that the production of zines and the handing off personally, zining, it's true, is like an object, but a zine is also a performance. And zining is about producing communities, about producing connection. And what Mimi has said in a wonderful interview with the underground publisher V. Vale in a book called Zines, is he asked her, well, why did you start Slant with the idea that it was going to be associated with her feminism? And she said, because I wanted to create a community for people of color, because we are struggling on our own within the punk world. We are struggling to communicate with each other. We are struggling to produce our own community. And so zines operate in that way. So the people of color, zine punksters of color critique is incredibly important.
Well, and but it gets back to this point that you're modeling not only that you're not only making the message and the content and talking about the issue itself, but also modeling the kind of community that you want.
Exactly.
You cannot do that through this culture of capital commodification. If you use
Absolutely.
That, you've lost the war. You have to use another means, an alternative means. Nikki, tell us about the kind of things that are featured in the zines and Brown Recluse.
We have currently over 100 zines, which is really phenomenal, and something when I started out with 20 zines in the distro 3 years ago. Some of the things that are featured, do you mean zine
yeah,
titles
some of the
or
topics,
just content?
Some of the content, because again, I think that's what we're talking about. If you've got a distribution network for zinesters of color, then what does that look like, and kind of what are the topics? What are people talking about?
They're varied. They're really all across the board. One of my favorite zines is Vital Signs, which is just about getting jobs in the medical field and going to medical school. And I really enjoy that because it talks about things outside of a context of race, but just about experience. But they also have another series that I really like put out by the university, by UW students, is called by UW students in a collective called Mixed. And it's called Please Tell Me More About Myself. And it's a collection. It kind of reminds me of like old school Riot Girl zines. And it's like a collection of people, younger people coming into consciousness about race and politics and gender and identity. So the content is really a lot, like spans from like just everyday mundane experiences in life to like the growing consciousness as you grow older.
We've been talking mostly about girl zines now, but joining us here on the State of Things at this moment is Bill Brown, who's a filmmaker, photographer, and creator of the zine Dream Whip, which he's been publishing since the early 1990s, and recently donated his large zine collection to Duke. He's also one of the people behind Zine Machine, Durham's first zine festival that happened earlier this year. Bill Brown, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hi, thanks.
So we've been talking about the idea of zines making a comeback in general. Do you agree?
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, tell us about the festival, because that was a big success and there was nothing happening here until then, right?
Yeah. So like you said, I've been zining forever, and I was aware of zine festivals, and for years they've existed. And it just occurred to me a couple years ago, well, what's going on down here in the Triangle, or is there a local zine fest? I was personally interested, and I noticed there was one going on in Richmond, Virginia, and I tried to register for a table, and they were all sold out. And I thought, oh my God, well, if there's that much interest in Richmond for a zine festival, why don't we have one? And
we got to have
Triangle?
A Durham.
I mean, come on. So, with two collaborators, Bill Fick, who's a colleague at Duke, and a terrific comics book artist named Everett Rand, we came up with this idea for Zine Machine. So we thought, okay, let's put together a festival, and we did. And we sold out the
tables. Who comes to the festival? Who's there?
Yeah, so this was our first take at it. And I have to say, I mean, I was interested too. I mean, I've got a 1990s, I'm a 90s era zine maker with maybe some 90s era ideas about who does a zine and what a zine looks like. So I was curious, what does a Durham, North Carolina Zine Festival look like in 2015. And so it's first come, first serve. So I don't know if this is particularly, I don't know if this is science.
okay.
But we saw also everything from a 10-year-old kid who does a comic book called Lightning Bolt through all sorts of zines that kind of match, I think, the sorts of zines we're talking about today, Xeroxed or screen printed multiples that deal with very personal issues, race, class, color, everything. And then we were seeing artists who were doing screen printing, making screen printed objects. There was a really wide range of responses.
Nikki Gomez, talking about that, I mean, you get requests from everywhere. Obviously, you've got a distribution network and a lot of small towns, places that aren't, I mean, there may be punk fans there, but certainly not vibrant punk communities. Tell us why you think these zines are striking a chord in all of these communities, now even outside what we would consider the punk world.
I think it's, again, just that, like, overall arching, like, wanting to really connect with people and looking for something authentic. And especially when you're stuck in a small town or a small scene or you're the only one, you're just really looking to connect. And the greater thing is, like, aesthetically, artistically, and creatively, you can, it's just, like, a huge palette in which you can work with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, now I'm wondering about the impact, Janice Radway, about whether or not we're seeing, I mean, it appears to us to be a kind of a flux, right, an ebb and flow. Probably it is a little more steady than that. It just depends on whether and when Newsweek decides to make it a feature story and then when the state of things will pick up on it. But in any case, do you see a steady increase? Is this really a movement that's kind of taking hold, or is it an ebb and flow, do you think?
I'm not sure anybody really knows. Certainly, zines have never disappeared. This form of alternative or underground self-publishing has been going on for a long time. There are even people that link this kind of self-publishing not just with the science fiction zines, but back to pamphlet literature from the early colonial period. So I think it's important to think about this as a practice, in addition to thinking about it as a set of objects to be read and worked with. So I think it's constantly been going on. Certainly, there are different historical moments where this kind of self-publishing experiences a real efflorescence. And I do think that zining persists despite social media, despite electronic communication, because as Nikki and Cindy and Bill have said, there is this longing for a kind of community, an alternative kind of community to the processed, commercialized, commodified culture that we're all familiar with. And I think that there is a response to that politically in this kind of underground. And I think it's not unrelated to the kind of politics we saw around the Seattle protests for the World Trade Organization. I think this there's real overlap in the zine community with Occupy. I think that this is a moment that you see developing, and I think it's a function of the historical period we're in.
Nikki Gomez, you've been distributing zines now for a while. Are you seeing people who are telling you, who are now producing a zine based on something they saw from Brown Recluse Distro?
Actually, no. No one's ever mentioned that.
just haven't gotten back to you yet.
Yeah, just hasn't gotten back to me yet. But what I have, the feedback that I have gotten is that people are, well, other than just orders, is that people are really stoked that this resource exists and, like, really stoked to, like, be able to find voices that reflect their experience and be able to find zines that reflect their experience, which is the thing that I felt I was lacking when I started it. I was looking at zine distros on the internet, trying to order zines and being like, I already have all of these zines, you know, by people of color.
Yeah,
by people of color. And, like, there has to be more. We're a very large population of people. We must be making content. And, yeah, that's exactly what happened. I receive more zines than I can possibly distribute.
Well, so. I want to thank all of you for being on our program today. Nikki Gomez, who is founder of Brown Recluse Zine Distro, a zine distributor geared toward zines written by and for people of color. Also joined by Kelly Wooten, who is a research services and collection development librarian at Duke Sally Bingham Center. And Janice Radway, a professor at Northwestern University, currently a fellow at the National Humanities Center in Durham, where she's working on a book about zine culture, and Bill Brown, the creator of the zine Dream Whip and one of the founders of the Zine Machine, which is Durham's new zine festival. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, Jana's going to be talking about her research at the National Humanities Center tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, and you can get details about that and all of our guests today at our website, stateofthings.org, a program that is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Widarski sitting in today. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.